Listen up. It's the Speakeasy with Annie Madden and Carla Treloar. Conversations in the margins. A comfortable space for uncomfortable topics.
Well, hello, Annie. We're back in Speakeasy. How are you?
I'm well. How are you today, Carla?
Yeah, Friday. We're recording on Friday.
Yeah. Woohoo!
So that woohoo was brought to you by our guest today, Marianne Jauncey. Welcome to this beautiful Speakeasy Lounge.
Thank you, Carla, Annie. It's a real pleasure to be here.
You're the director of the Medically Supervised Injecting Centre in Sydney, public health doctor, right before that working at Kirkton Road Centre. What's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this? I mean, it's cheeky perhaps, but, you know, it's not the most glamorous of professions or specialties for someone with a medical background to go into. So what happened?
Yeah, look, it's a good question, and I'm not sure I've necessarily got a nice, neat answer. I suppose, like a lot of people, I fell into it. You know, I don't think most of us plan our careers really all that clearly. You know, I was the typical naive kind of medical student that thought she'd go out and save the world and, you know, all that crap. and I, you know, I guess I didn't realise that there was third world health in a first world country so close to the centre of Sydney. And, you know, I started in King's Cross, and it was actually a friend of mine found an ad for, and it said, quote unquote, flexible and eclectic approach needed to work with vulnerable populations of King's Cross. And she sent it to me and she said, oh, this sounds like you. And I went, oh, flexible and eclectic. I'm not sure how I should take that, but okay. You know, turned up, and working at Kirkton Road was an extraordinary experience for me, because I'd just done the typical doctory medical student things at, you know, public hospitals, and not really thought at all about, you know, I didn't have any personal experience or family experience of injecting drug use or illicit drug use. And it was a real eye-opener, but for so many different reasons. And the first thing that really struck me was just the quality of the medicine in terms of actually meeting somebody where they're at, and the incredible transformative power of treating people with dignity and respect. And that
so
sounds
simple,
so twee, but it's just having watched it and been there and lived it and seen it, it is genuinely transformative. And you just think, gosh, if I could bring that to a little bit broader aspects of the healthcare in this country.
It's amazing just how much not being treated that way can kind of ground, you know, grind people into the ground rather quickly, really. But a little bit of being treated with dignity and respect, people just sort of stand a little bit taller in the world, don't they? And
they
feel like they can do more.
Yeah, you know, they really do. It's and it sort of, it partly, you know, partly makes me really proud of the service where I now work, you know, the Uniting Service of, you know, where we supervise drug injection. But it also at the same time makes me really sad, because I guess it makes me reflect on, you know, some great
how
people, but the system, you know, also, you know, delivers this inherent clash between people who use drugs and people who work in the health system. And it really doesn't need to be that way.
So, you know, Kirkton Road and the Injecting Centre both have very strong harm reduction principles, which typically are not the way the rest of the community thinks, and probably not the way in which medical training is structured. So, you know, you're very experienced in this area now, but do you remember this isn't what I'm used to, this is quite challenging? And
funnily enough, I'm not sure that I do. Like, I think the term harm reduction has become quite polarizing, unfortunately, but actually, you know, why do we put seatbelts in cars if we're never going to have an accident? Yeah. Why do we have sunscreen? Why do we have, you know, like, life is about harm reduction. Why do you tell your kids to look left and right and left again? And, you know, all of the time in everything we are doing, we are taking calculated risks and trying to keep people safe. The people that we love, our absolute priority is to keep them safe. So there is actually no difference between the rest of medicine and the rest of life and harm reduction. It's an absolute core part of human nature. But because of the fact that it's about drugs, that's what makes it seem different. I actually don't think it is different. It just makes it seem different because of this inherent, incredible fear that that simple word brings out in people.
It's really extraordinary. So actually, in that context, that sort of, you know, the different way these issues get treated. So as we said, you're the medical director for the Medically Supervised Injecting Centre in King's Cross. And I mean, it's fair to say that centre has had more than its fair share of controversy and you know, contentious issues to deal with since it's sort of just over 15 years, I guess, that it's been around. But, you know, I guess it'd be good to hear what's happening for the centre now. What are the, you know, we're aware of that kind of contentious history, but it's been, you know, bedded down for a while now. What are the current issues? I've certainly heard you've got a fabulous consumers advisory group or something like that, but it'd be great to hear some of those nice positive stories out of what the centre's now doing, you know.
Yeah, so I think probably the first thing in terms of what's new and different for us is, of course, the reality that in a few months' time, we hope to not be the only supervised injecting facility in the Southern Hemisphere. So obviously when we opened in 2001, we were the only service in the English-speaking world. We were the first, and there was, as you say, an enormous amount of controversy, and that was Dr. Van Beek, who was the medical director back then, and, you know, hats off to her and all of the people at Uniting that really stood up to what was an extraordinary onslaught. The onslaught continued for a lot longer than I think probably many of us have expected. But it's genuinely exciting for us that there's going to be a sister service, if you like, open up in Melbourne, which is due for the middle of the year. So obviously we're working really hard with them to provide as much advice and support and whatever that we can. And just the idea that somebody else will have the same job title as me in their country is actually kind of exciting. Because you do appreciate just being able to bounce ideas and you know, talk about someone who is going through the same issues as you. So that will actually be genuinely, genuinely exciting for us. And then, as you say, we have a consumer action group, or the CAG group as they're called. And I think the reality is that drug and alcohol have really been poor second cousins to mental health in terms of having the consumer voice or the affected community involved in decision making, in service delivery, in policy direction, in strategic direction. And, you know, we've not always been super great at it at MSIC. And we've had some really wonderful staff members who have really championed that. And so we've now got
takes that, doesn't it? That, you know, sort of one or more people, you know, on staff to really commit to.
Yeah, because I think if you've just got one person, but you don't have the people to kind of implement it and champion it amongst your staff, it is hard. And it does take a little bit of a shift for some people. You know, as when you're a healthcare provider, your notion of how stuff works is you go and you provide the care. Whereas what we're really trying to do is, yes, we are a professional service, and yes, we're not seeing, you know, our equals or we're not seeing our friends, if you like, but we are seeing our equals. We are seeing other human beings, and as much as we can to actually shift that dynamic a bit so that there is an empowerment of the people that come in. So it has taken, I think, you know, a bit of a shift in culture for us, but I'm just so thrilled at how it's going, and the group itself is really, you know, really powering from strength to strength, and have done some wonderful things. So they've had the police up. You know, one of the issues that they raised was that
challenging.
And you know, we didn't know how that was going to go.
Yeah,
but we've got a really, you know, at a management level and a service level, we've got a really good relationship with the police. The local police are one of the licensing authorities for the service, so they've always been supportive. But of course, the reality is where the rubber hits the road, you've got people who are inherently criminalised coming to a service, and police whose job it is to arrest people who are criminals. So there is obviously a bit of tension at that kind of, you know, pointy end of things, if you like, pardon the pun. So we had the crime manager and one of the other senior police come and not only hear from the consumer group, but then present to the consumer group. And it just made me tingle. It was so respectful and so constructive. And both groups, like I spoke both with the police as well as with the consumers afterwards, and both of them were buzzing.
Oh, fantastic.
Both of them were actually buzzing. So
what were the kind of issues that consumers wanted to raise with the police?
They just wanted to talk about the fact that when you guys give us a move-on order, when you guys actively police, you know, it means we can't come to a service. Let me tell you a little bit about my life. Mm. You know, there's a really... People want to be able to sort of say to somebody, walk a mile in my shoes and then tell me what you'd do. And the police were extraordinarily respectful.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, if I'm honest, they probably went in a little bit tentative themselves, thinking we're just going to get hammered abused, we're going to get hammered. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case. That didn't happen at all. And, you know, speaking with them afterwards, like, oh, Marianne, that was, oh, wow, I really learnt some stuff. Gosh, oh, that was really, you know, generous of them to provide that information and that context and those stories. And and you think so much could happen if we just get people to talk to each other.
Yeah, well, exactly. It raises for me a little anecdote. And, you know, with your kind support, we ran a survey with clients at the Injecting Centre a couple of years ago, and we provided for every participant a little health promotion pack. So it was a toothbrush, toothpaste and sugar-free chewing gum in a little Ziploc bag. And one of the clients who participated was stopped by police outside the injecting centre and accused of stealing those from one of the local pharmacies and given a move-on order, locked out of the cross for 12 hours. And you think, so we wrote a letter to the Australian New Zealand Journal of Public Health and said, you know, think about what the potential this has, that... it was a client of the injecting centre, so that client was going to return to inject. Mm. They couldn't, so where might that have happened, and all the all possible the consequences of that, and let alone any other service that they may want to relied upon for food, for housing in that area. And, you know, that we learn our lesson, and we then put a little slip of paper that said, this is a health promotion pack provided by the University of New South Wales. Back off. But
and we've had to do a similar thing with naloxone. So we provide naloxone, which is obviously the heroin antidote, or the, you know, the anti-overdose drug. And we've had instances very similar to what you're talking about, Carla, where our clients have been stopped and, you know, what is this drug? And it's like, trust me, this is not a drug of abuse. and so equally, we have a little slip in there. But I guess, you know, what it highlights for me too is it's a tough position for police to be in, because they're being told that they have to enforce the law. You know, there's a lot of, you know, there's good and bad people in all professions.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of wonderful, you know, police that are genuinely trying to make a difference. And it just highlights to me that we do need to just have a bit of a rethink, people, about what are we trying to do with the drug laws that we have.
Exactly. Nobody is... It's the criminalisation that gets in the way of that understanding, that relationship, every time, doesn't it? It just is, you know, there's limits to where anything can go on either side of that, you know, that divide, if you like, because of those drug laws and because of criminalisation. Like, if you're a drug user sitting in a room as a consumer representative or whatever, talking to police, you're going to have in the back of your mind, I think I'll just hold back that bit of information, or this, because, you know, that could be used against me or my peers, even if it's something that, you know, you think could be helpful, actually, but you're always going to be a bit reluctant.
Sure.
Now, you mentioned that there may be someone with the same job title as you in the coming months. I've never thought about it like that. Wait, that's pretty amazing, isn't it? Unique position. So, you know, we hopefully got our fingers crossed for that service in Victoria. Things are happening in other parts of the world. What lessons could be learnt with hindsight from the operation of the Sydney site that the new sites could follow?
I guess, I mean, one of the really lovely things for us has been the clear and unambiguous support that we've received from our local community. And we would very much pride ourselves on being a part of our local community and very much a solution to a local problem, with residents and businesses really coming in behind us. And the crucial message there, I think, is that a supervised injecting facility really is a win-win. It's actually better for everybody. Regardless of what your views about drug use or drug users are, if you live and work in a local community where there is lots of public injecting, lots of ambulances being called to overdose, lots of needles in the streets, that's not pleasant for you. It's not pleasant for the people using those drugs. Mm. Allowing that activity to occur in a safer, sanitary, supervised health service is genuinely a win-win. So really highlighting the benefits for the local community as well as the population of people that we see. Also, I think the fact that it can work really well with police. You know, I've seen a couple of articles recently, including some from North America about, you know, what does this mean, and one from Ireland recently about, well, you know, they've passed legislation and looking at opening up a service in Dublin. And there was an article recently about the police sort of saying, well, you know, what does that mean for us? And I think, guys, you've been doing this for a long time. Like in this country, in Australia, we've been providing clean injecting equipment knowingly to people who inject drugs for 30 plus years. Police know how to operate. They've got standard operating procedures for how to operate around an area where needles and syringes are provided. It's actually no different. I mean, the reality is we've been providing those needles and then telling people to go away.
Yeah.
We're not really doing something incredibly new or wild or innovative or different. All we're doing is providing the clean needles that we have always done and then not, you know, wiping our hands of the person and sending them back out into the public dark alleyways or behind a parked car. It's not really a big leap.
And so long as all the proper legislation and regulations and whatever is needed behind the scenes to back that facility up, then the police can just do their job, can't they?
Yeah.
There's nothing.
And, you know, we genuinely work well with our local police. I mean, we really don't call them very often, you know, literally barely a handful of times a year. But, gosh, when we do, we'd really like them to come. Mm-hmm. And they are there within, you know, moments, and they're brilliant.
Yeah.
So it really doesn't need to be the inevitable clash that people presume it will be.
Yeah.
The other thing is, I guess, about, you know, different service models suit different locations. I think probably, you know, when we first opened in 2001, there was only about 40 services around the world. There's now, you know, in the order of 110. And I guess what I've learnt is that you can have different models to suit the different context. So they don't all have to be very large standalone services. You can have much smaller services. You can have integrated services.
More community-based rather than super medicalised, all that.
Yeah, stuff. You know, there's different models that will work for different, you know, contexts, really.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, of course, you know, we couldn't really interview you today without talking about the new work that is coming up, that is a new drug law reform campaign, as I understand it, that's being led by the ACT and New South Wales Uniting Church Diocese. I mean, that just sounds like, you know, why would some church administrators be interested in drug law reform? I mean, with respect, it's a kind of unusual. Can you tell us what the backstory on that is?
And I'm so proud of Uniting. So obviously the medically supervised injecting centre is run by Uniting, and they're the services and advocacy arm of the Uniting Church in New South Wales and ACT. And in April of 2016, a paper was presented to the Synod, which is the, you know, the overarching governing body for all of the presbyteries of the Uniting Church in New South Wales and ACT. And there were some presentations, including a presentation by a wonderful woman called Marion McConnell from Families and Friends of Drug Law Reform in the ACT. And she spoke about the impact of drug laws on her family and her son, who was a heroin user, and who the police attended when he had an ambulance, and the police attended when the ambulance attended an overdose that he had, that he survived. But not long after that, he wasn't alive anymore, and he ran away from treatment services, and he ran away from support, and he tried to hide. And, you know, I think what she has learnt is the reality that when you criminalise someone with problematic drug use, where it is far better that you sit them in front of a counsellor rather than a courtroom, you know, she's extremely eloquent, you know, out of that incredible tragedy has, you know, she's really done some amazing work. And so, you know, that was the beginning of a process that ultimately went to the Synod making a decision that that criminalising people on the basis of merely using or possessing a small amount of drugs for their own personal use is absolutely and utterly counterproductive and creates more harm than good. So this is not, you know, Uniting is not an organisation that is promoting drug use, but they actually provide services, you know, literally from the cradle to the grave. And their mantra is about, you know, giving a voice to the voiceless and standing up for marginalised populations. And I guess what they know and what they see through their services is that problematic drug use is not limited to the one service called the Medically Supervised Injecting Centre in King's Cross. It is a, you know, very much part and parcel of the childhood trauma, the marginalisation, the mental health issues, the homelessness, that is, you know, inherently woven through many of the families that they're seeing. Mm. You know, it doesn't operate in isolation, in a silo. Mm. So well, I'm genuinely proud that they're going to, you know, that they're standing up, and hopefully I would like to think that there's an opportunity to sort of change the conversation, because as we were talking before, there's this incredible fear just associated with the word drug, and so much of that comes from the moralising and the inherent good, bad, right, wrong.
Yeah. Illegal equals immoral.
Yeah, and I think, you know, regardless of what your religious views or your faith views are, and I mean, I'm not a member of the Uniting Church, I'm a proud employee of Uniting, but I'm not a member of the church. But I think to have a faith-based voice proudly standing up and saying, these are our people, and, you know, criminalising someone on the basis that they've used a substance, and there's, you know, obviously a range of reasons that people use substances, but, you know, some of the time that's because some stuff has gone on in their life, and that there has to be a better way.
And good on them for joining the dots too, you know, that not siloing off this one particular part, because the faith-based organisations do have a huge role in our society of providing services to, like you say, the marginalised families or people, and drug use runs through many of those stories, and then incarceration has further family disruptions, employment impacts on release, and on and on and on and on. So taking this core element, you know, in dreamscape of reaching the output that that the United Church is advocating for, taking out that criminalisation step will have not trickle but gush on effects to so many different other parts of their service provision, which is a big spend of the government, Commonwealth government, across the country with Uniting and the other faith-based providers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was really, you know, some of the, so there's a number of people. So John O'Brien heads up the Social Justice Forum, and Caitlin Scott is one of the chaplains, and both of those are working with us. And we were, you know, talking about the sort of the faith-based or theological underpinnings for this the other day, and Caitlin was just talking, and she said that for her, she said it's sort of the law that we're asking is, and you know, her words were, the law that love requires. And what she was sort of, you know, paraphrasing from something in the Bible, and she would do it far more eloquently than me if she was here, is that actually if everything goes back to love of your fellow man, then this change in law is what is required. And it really gave me, you know, it really gave me sort of tingles down my spine. Again, as a non-church-going person, I
and
thought,
not, yeah,
you know, I'm
not,
proud of this organisation.
Absolutely.
I'm really proud of
and
this organisation.
It's not a million miles away from what we've recently been through as an Australian society or community around marriage equality and the fundamentals that are under that. I mean, it's not really about, I mean, it's about marriage, but it's actually fundamentally about equality.
Absolutely,
and treating
Annie.
People with equality, you know, and dignity and respect, and really following through with that in terms of what we do and how our world operates. And this issue, you know, this is just in a logical extension, extending all those same principles to something like this.
Couldn't agree more. And the thing that, you know, there are times I'm sure that all of us get absolutely and utterly disillusioned by what is going on in the world, and we only need to look towards, you know, Trump's America to think, why? But if you know, so for example, if you break down the Trump vote by age, you know, being young was the single biggest determining factor for not voting for Trump. And it does give me hope. Like, I do feel like, I don't know what you guys think, but I do feel like around the world there is an increasing momentum towards the clear benefits of equality, and the reality that if we removed, you know, the criminal sanctions for certain drugs, because, of course, we're just talking about certain mind-altering substances, aren't we? Not all of them. Some of them are glorified and, you know, held up as the only way to be a true Australian.
Exactly.
You know, I do feel like there is momentum globally.
Yeah.
And an understanding that, you know, this war on drugs, it's a war on people of colour, it's a war on marginalised communities. It's actually, in a funny way, not about anything to do with drugs.
No.
It's all to do with the people we don't like and the other.
Absolutely, I completely agree. And just quickly on that, so what does that campaign practically look like? What is it? Is there anything you can talk about right now that it's going to do, or how are we going to see it?
So it's early days, and there's a sort of a broad range of strategies that are going to be rolling out. So there'll definitely be more in this space, and you might get one of the campaign team maybe in at some point to talk.
But there's love to do that.
Yeah, yeah, there's various sort of stakeholder groups or layers of the cake as we talk about, and we need an engagement and a communication strategy for all of those because the messages are slightly different whether you're the police or friends and families or members of the church or volunteers and staff of Uniting or, you know, whoever you are. So there's particular engagement and communication strategies that we've got. We've got a group of like-minded organisations that we'd like to, you know, bring together under a banner of being absolutely clear about what we believe and what we want to advocate and work towards. The development of a white paper about, you know, the view that we have about the why and the as well as the how.
Yep.
And, you know, ultimately there'll be some, you know, much more public facing aspects to this. We really want to involve the church as well, and we're keen to sort of listen to people and not just come out and say we have all of the answers.
Yeah.
Mm. There's been some work done with Alison Ritter and Alyssa Greer through UNSW, trying to make sure that we hear the voices of the affected, you know, communities, other service users of Uniting. So it's early days, and there's a lot of things that are sort of all coming together.
Mm.
Watch this space.
Terrific leadership from the Uniting, and hopefully the other faith-based providers in this space, or just faith-based organisations, can really grab that. You know, love thy neighbour. Totally uneducated.
That's right. The law that love requires. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Thank you, Caitlin.
Yeah. I've just learnt that "Kick Against the Pricks" is not just a Nick Cave album, but he's also biblically based. So, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Education is out there.
Well, Nick likes his religious references.
He does, doesn't he?
Sure. Yeah.
So, heading towards our finish line, Marianne, you know, you're totally enmeshed in the Sydney Medically Supervised Injecting Centre, but what else is going on? What's next for you? What's grabbing your attention? What's coming up? What's interesting work you want to tell us about?
I guess the thing that I would really like to see, and I certainly don't have the answers as to how we do it, but if we can somehow use this incredible change in terms of the social media, the 24-hour news cycle, the Twitter, the Instagrams, the connectivity that we have, to actually genuinely increase the active engagement of our community in our democracy. You know, how do we go from just the very simple clickbait, 3-second grabs, reactive front page headlines, blah, screaming this, bang, click this, to using this technology somehow to bringing about a much more nuanced, clever, you know, integrated conversation where we can actually explore issues and go beyond the 3-second grab and beyond the headline, but actually meaningfully engage people in a dialogue and then in the active decision making that ultimately is the basis of democracy. You know, I think there is still, unfortunately, I mean, I'm a big believer in compulsory voting, but there are still many people who, you know, either make up their mind on the day or are completely swayed by, you know, a single issue.
Or just really isolated from the process, aren't they? They're just disengaged from the process.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, I don't know how, but I would like to think that we're supposed to be all more connected than ever before, but are we? And what can we do, you know, through a university or through public institutions to really actually genuinely increase, you know, that meaningful dialogue.
Yeah. And that's part of the reason why we, you know, jokes aside, why we're in this room is to just take this moment and unpack something with the experts to lead us down a new way of thinking or elaborate these ideas or allow people to hear things they may not have otherwise heard before in this flashy grab, I've only got 10 seconds to listen to you world.
So if there is something that, you know, you as a listener or anyone in this room, if there's something that we not only feel passionate about but we know about, why is it that we don't not only write to our local MPs but make an appointment and go and visit them? Because we don't do it.
There's participation right there.
You know, we don't do it. And yet they are making decisions on behalf of us. Mm-hmm. So what is it that we need to do? Like, if people, why is it that, you know, I often at conferences say, who recently in the last 12 months has written to an MP? Who's done it ever? It is not the majority of the people in the room.
And you think, why? Sort of, some ways I think people see them as sort of kind of different to them, these kind of exalted people. You know, I mean, I know we make a lot of jokes about our politicians as Australians and stuff, and we sort of perhaps...
Yeah, not that exalted.
Don't even regard them very well. But in actual fact, like, I do some training with drug users, and one of the things I'll say is, oh, yes, you know, I've been on a Prime Minister's committee, or I've, you know, travelled to New York with Kevin Rudd, or those sorts of things. And they're like, oh, my God, you know, like, it's sort of beyond their imagination that, I guess it's because I'm a drug user as well, but it's beyond, it's that engagement with, what I take from it is that engagement with parliamentarians and with politicians is something that ordinary people just kind of don't see in their scope, really.
And yet it's absolutely in our scope, isn't
it? Absolutely, it is completely. You can just write and knock and get an appointment, and they will. They must, in fact.
And you can tell your story, and you know an awful lot more about certain things than they do.
That's right. And they will listen, and it does, in fact, change people's views. You know,
absolutely. And, I mean, I think you more than anyone, Annie, you know, in terms of the power of a personal story, you know, you have seen that and been that and lived that.
It does, you know, it is worth pursuing it. I agree with you completely, and it is a very a space we haven't explored anywhere near enough as a kind of democratic nation. Yeah, I agree.
Well, there's a great call to action. Get your pens out. Get knocking on the door.
Pick up your phone. Yeah. Tweet. I don't know how you get in contact with them these days.
All of the above.
All of the above, that's right. Yeah.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure having you in our little sweatbox of a speakeasy lounge.
So. Thank you, gals. I don't know when this goes to air, but happy belated International Women's Day to everybody.
Yes.
For more information about this podcast, our guests and upcoming episodes, head to http://csrh.arts.unsw.edu.au.